How could the recession be good for the economy? Could technology and innovation emerge as the phoenix from the ashes of our financial system? The answer to these questions and more on this week's Radio Berkman. For many, rampant unemployment and the roller coaster descent into the recession are moderately dispiriting signs. Well, the until recently employed and budget-strapped technology businesses may find the current climate ripe for taking new chances. David Hornick, partner in the venture investment firm August Capital, is one of those who sees great opportunity for entrepreneurs who want to take a chance on tech, in spite of how irrational it might seem right now. He sat down with David Weinberger to explore how innovation may be impacted by a desperate economy.
I think there is some impact. I think that there is an impact in the aggregate amount of innovation. On the other hand, if you look over time, the number of interestingly large, exciting technologies that have emerged in good times and bad, pretty consistent. And so I think that the reality is that great technology and great innovation is rewarded in good times and bad, and so there's sufficient motivation to create it. And it maybe takes longer when there's less wind to your back, less economic wind to your back, but great innovation will always take place.
In the past few years, increasingly, this is anecdotal anyway, a lot of the engineers that I know who have a good idea, their first move is to outsource the actual development of it. They will come up with the idea and they'll specify the code and they'll find a programmer at one of the many services that do this. That seemed to lower the hurdle for getting an idea from the shower, onto first initial take on a computer. Does that path still work? Are more people going to be going down that path?
The big question is how fully do you have to commit to try out an idea to get things going? And I do think that floor has been lowered quite a bit. Now you can, for a relatively small amount of money, you can develop something, see if it's interesting, see how it works. Our business has stayed the same, which is ultimately to provide money to expand on good ideas, to help drive ideas that take more money to get to fruition, etc. But this idea of being able to prototype and demonstrate these things early is absolutely not going anywhere. And because it is so cheap and because it takes so little money and effort and time, I think it's just going to accelerate. The other thing about this time is that there are a lot of people who, end up with more time on their hands by virtue of having, found their jobs disappeared or between things in a time when it's hard to find something new to do. And so to fill that time, they end up innovating on interesting things. I'm an investor in Six Apart in the blogging space, and it was started during similar time in the early 2000s when Ben and Mina Trott, the founders of Six Apart, were no longer out there at their jobs. They found that this was something interesting to do on the side to try and fill the time, and it turned into quite an interesting and important piece of software, or now pieces of software that have driven the blogosphere. And so do I expect to hear those sorts of stories for sure coming from 2008 forward? You bet. And so in many ways it may increase innovation because people have, they're not constrained by working at JP Morgan in the IT department or whatever.
I've long thought that on the other side, exactly the blogging story, was that the growth of blogging during the time of the recession, that helped tremendously because not just because the software was developed, but because so many people had time on their hands that they could actually write the blogs, and getting enough enough blogs written was also obviously crucial to spreading the idea of blogging as well. So recession was very good for blogging on both sides of it.
Absolutely. And it's actually already proven good for a bunch of things. Like, if you look at the trends in places like Second Life, where you would think, okay, what will the impact of the economy be on a Second Life? Well, it turns out that people have more time, they're more engaged, they engage in the community. I sort of look at it, in the most simplistic sense, it's sort of bread and circus, right? I mean, ultimately, if you have time on your hands in between these things, do you want to dwell on the troubles you're having? Or do you want to focus on things that are distracting and hopefully entertaining? And so, for sure, I think gaming will benefit, and online gaming and those sorts of things, blogging.
But I'm wondering, it sounds a little Pollyanna-ish to me. should we be that, you know, sort of happy about the state that we're in?
My sense of it is that that there's sort of a steady state of great entrepreneurship, right? That entrepreneurs are by and large internally driven. They're not externally driven, right? We saw that for sure in the late 90s when it seemed like there was this incredible money train and you just hopped on it and you collected your, you know, and you picked up your bags of cash. And so lots of people left jobs that otherwise were not entrepreneurial in any way to become quote unquote entrepreneurs. And they failed. I mean, you know, some of them may have ultimately made that transition, but by and large, those people were motivated not by this desire to build exciting technologies or to serve, you know, solve a problem or serve a market or whatever. They were driven by this desire to hop on the money train. I think that entrepreneurship is not about that at all. If you don't wake up in the morning and either say, oh, I've got this problem I want to solve, or I just can't work for someone else because I need to build something for myself, you know, you're going to have a really hard time in any market. But the good news about that is that those people, that they spring forth independent of the economic circumstances. And to a certain extent, they, you know, the really serious, focused entrepreneurs pop out during a time when it's an irrational thing to do. It's an irrational thing to start a company right now. And yet, if you're so driven by the idea you have, by the problem you're trying to solve, that you still are motivated to build a company, you know, I think that increases the likelihood that you succeed at it.
I've heard it said, actually, this is a great time to start a company because, especially an entrepreneurial tech company, because by the time you bring your product to market, we hope, be out of the recession and companies be looking at investing again and buying new technology and the like. Is that just making ourselves feel better, or is there some truth to that?
Well, there's definitely some truth to that, right? I hear lots of investors who say, oh, it's a tough time to invest and I'm not putting new money to work and we're trying to focus on the things that we've done, etc. Well, the reality is, the things that were funded 3-4 years ago that now are trying to grow revenue and build, et cetera, are the ones that are being hit by this economy. Whereas the early stage companies, I funded 2 really early stage companies this summer and early fall. And, you know, there are a million things that are going to create problems for them. The economy is not one of them. But I think it's true, to tell you the truth, that the interesting stuff that's built now and manages to power through, as I say, make it through the desert. If you come out the other side of the desert and, you know, a couple things have happened. If there were competitors, the likelihood that more than one of you have made it through the desert is relatively low. In a really strong economy, it's very hard to hire people. In 2006-07, you know, for every person that one of my internet companies saw and software service companies was trying to hire, Google had an offer out at twice the price we were willing to pay, and Yahoo was clamoring to hire them, and Microsoft. I mean, it just is incredibly competitive. Well, right now, guess what? It's not that competitive. There are lots of really smart people who have time on their hands, who are available, or who are more willing to consider the opportunity to go, you know, go work with startups that are well funded, etc. And so, but it's, you know, it's not devoid of challenges.
Not devoid of challenges, yes. Oh, laughing through the past the graveyard. I've also heard it said that this is actually a good time for customers, for large companies in particular, to be investing in tech because tech brings some level of efficiency or productivity, and so they are in fact more willing than they might be in a difficult time to make the investments that matter, other than the Obama hope for computerizing medical records, which seems like that sort of investment. What sorts of technologies?
Well, I'll give you an example, a completely self-serving example. It's a company I've invested in called Splunk. And Splunk is a piece of software that allows you to create essentially a search engine in your data center. It takes all your log files, correlates them together, and allows you to do a bunch of functions across those files. And so you can do system management, you can do compliance, you can do security, those sorts of things with the Splunk software. Well, they have a number of competitors in each of these verticals that are much more expensive to run and manage and to continue to pay the licensing fees from big enterprise software companies. And therefore, you can imagine Splunk, despite the downturn in the economy, is doing quite well. Hundreds of new enterprises a quarter are using Splunk because, you know, those are pretty easy choices. Do you want A, more, which is more expensive and less function, or B, less expensive, more function?
On the downside, you have to use the phrase, I'm going to install a Splunk.
Yes, right. So. I will have to Splunk it. Right. That is a downside, but it makes for a good t-shirt. The second category is a category of technology that is largely assumed to be dead, which is this idea that it's sort of the Big Bang. If you spend $2 million, you will get some big outcome that will ultimately drive a huge amount of cost out of your business or drive increased profits, etc. And so all you need to do is have faith that these things will in fact occur and you'll buy it. And so, you know, great example of these sorts of softwares. Imagine back in the late 90s when we had these huge SAP implementations and Siebel implementations, and there were lots of promises and there are lots of stories about, oh man, you know, a wake of deaths and a whole lot of missed opportunity while spending a lot of money, right? So I think that those things will be under huge pressure, despite the fact that if those are demonstrably true, right? If you have a set of customers who are attesting to the value of these things, it is still in your interest as a company to spend that money, right? It is in your interest to spend $2 million today to save $10 million over the next 2 years. And so those companies that are willing to take the time and make those efforts and invest in the things that have driven those sorts of values, I think will emerge from these economic times much stronger than the ones who say we can't possibly invest in technology.
Would Web 2.0 have prevented, if it had been adopted by the relevant industries, would it have prevented the economic liquefaction?
Right. To the extent that this is a problem, an information problem, and that if people had full information, then they would have never allowed a set of things to occur, right? There were sets of securities that should never have existed and on full knowledge would not have their, Web 2.0 and the broader dissemination of information could certainly help that problem. On the other hand, you know, these industries had a lot at stake in not allowing the dissemination of information, which is a shame. I mean, and if the information were fully available, then all of the tools that you and I have for social media would have solved this problem because we would have seen it coming and we would not have allowed it.
Although as
you and I, because we're in charge,
right? The venality of our species, however, as you say, mitigates our actually using those tools for maximum transparency because they're such strong. You can make out like a bandit if you don't.
I will say that I think that in Silicon Valley in the late 90s when there was a bursting of the bubble, we venture investors in Silicon Valley in large part were blamed for this, for the challenges. And we have no moral high ground, right? Because last time around, we can make lots of excuses and explanations, but at least you could point quite clearly to this was a tech bubble and it exploded. This time around, it has nothing to do with tech, right? And so, thank goodness, because I don't think that we could sustain a couple of those. I think that in this instance, that technology and the tech community have worked hard to try and help solve these problems. But man, it's pushing against a really big, as you say, a big, big rock.
So you're in a special position, David. You're a good friend of the Berkman Center. You've taught a course at Harvard Law.
Yep.
With John Palfrey?
I did. Right? Entrepreneurship and Venture Capital, which I believe we'll be teaching again in 2010. So that'd be great.
So you are more involved in the life of the university than I'll venture to say most VCs are. What do you see as the missing areas of opportunity for collaboration between these two worlds?
It's incredibly hard to imagine how the two groups come together, right? I've seen this certainly in the context of research, but I've even seen it in the context of technology transfer organizations. So universities have these groups called the technology transfer organization, and their job is to figure out how to extract value from the technologies that have been created inside of their universities that have no particular application to date. So they've patented lots of things, but it's research and so they're missing the D. They got the R, but they don't have the D. So who's going to come do the development? And so organizations like Stanford and MIT and Caltech in particular have quite well-honed organizations, I'm sure Harvard as well, trying to extract these pieces of technology and get them commercialized because there's real value to the university. Case in point, Google, when Google was pulled out, there was a patent that existed that resulted in Stanford owning a chunk of Google, which was ultimately worth hundreds of millions of dollars. So from a university standpoint, if you can create these organizations, it's just free money, right? Because the research has been done. It's done in the context of the university. So how do you make this happen? And so we have this kind of dance between venture investors and these tech transfer groups that are supposed to have us come and commercialize their stuff, and everybody makes a lot of money, and it's a big happy story. But the story of all these things is that there was some person who said, I want to commercialize this, or I want to create this relationship, and I want to drive the business forward, or et cetera. Devoid of a person, an individual, in most instances a professor who's worked on the technology and is the expert, it's incredibly hard to figure out how you take people and connect them to technologies, or with the Berkman Center, how do you take, you know, research and connect it to entrepreneurs to drive, you know, some more commercialization of the sets of things that are happening. When you meet with a Twitter or, you know, or a Yammer, the enterprise Twitter, and then you sit here in the Berkman Center and hear how Enterprise 2.0 is used elsewhere, that's an interesting and valuable connection. But ultimately, you know, it's the people interacting that's going to drive that value back and forth. And so I think that the key is to have more involvement, both from folks like me, spending more time with the people who are doing the interesting research, and also from the folks who are looking at these problems, spending more time out in Silicon Valley or out in, you know, in the venture community in Boston, to sort of understand how the two worlds think.
David, shouldn't we just get some social networking tools? We'll tag some stuff up. We'll set up a wiki. We'll set up a Facebook group and that.
Sweet.
The magic happens.
Well, I'm signed up. I'm in. I mean, you know, the interesting thing is there are economic organizations that scares the crap out of. Like, just they really aren't interested in that piece of input. Or, you know,
the business commercial side is.
It's dirty. It's, you know, I mean, I think that there's still some of that. When I also teach at Harvard Business School, and obviously commercial is not a dirty word in the business school, whereas in the law school, I think it continues to be more academic and less focused, or feeling, or you know, there's sort of this a greater sense of tension between the greater good and the economic good.
Well, as a research institute, we are committed to impartial research, whereas business is committed to partiality.
But I think that Berkman Center and others would be well served to recognize the impact, the pulls of economics, of these sort of broader market impacts when looking at this research. And I think actually Berkman Center is doing that, continues to do that, will continue to do that. And I, you know, so that's why I'm not kicked out of here on my tush, you know. But it is this interesting, you know, you can imagine a center for philosophy and a center for venture capital might have a more challenging relationship, you know, whereas, you know, working at Stanford Business School, there isn't a whole lot. There is a pretty good mind meld over what is the ultimate goal. Even in social entrepreneurship, which is fine. Again, in social entrepreneurship, there are different pulls, but I think it's the same kind of market forces, and we can think about them.
David Hornick of August Capital, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
David Hornick is a partner at August Capital and a lecturer at Stanford's Graduate School of Business. He blogs at ventureblog.com. This episode of Radio Berkman was produced by me, Daniel Jones, at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. You can find more programs like this and subscribe to our podcast at blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman.